I'm here to negotiate with Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg.
They saw that our general purpose was bigger than just our company.
It's not normal, is it, that one guy called Peter owns so much of this infrastructure?
I'm sort of the developer, a guy that sees opportunities and look around the next corner to see what's happening next and try to position ourselves into that.
He is a visionary leader. He is a businessman in a number of verticals, including data centers, fiber networks, connections across oceans, and it all started in industrial real estate. He has Amazon.com as a paying client. He has Google as a infrastructure partner. He is building high-tech business in Venezuela. How does he do that? He's the founder and very active main owner and chairman of Bulk. Welcome to the Arctic Podcast Studio, Mr. Peter Nabe.
Thank you very much, Jette.
I think we have to start with Venezuela because I come from Kristiansand. And when you come from Kristiansand, Venezuela is sort of a place you laugh a little bit about. It's it's a little bit small place, inland. They used to have a pulp and paper operation that went bankrupt. Why? How did you come up with the idea to make a data center business in Venezuela?
Venezuela is of course, inside of Kristiansand. So Kristiansand is more known. It's a very southern tip of Norway. But it's also the most powerful junction of power being fed as renewable energy in the whole of Europe. So it's the most scalable site for a large scale data center project.
Did you start by looking for the best place, or did you start at Venezuela?
I started looking for the best place. I also went way up north in Norway and realized the distances in latency, which data travels in fiber networks. And as light travels over distance, it takes some time to go to and from. And this is, of course, also one of the aspects that you need to consider if you want to build up a scalable data center business.
And why is the infrastructure so good in Venezuela? Is this the old pulp and paper factory that had the hydropower energy coming in, or?
No, Venezuela is in the heart of the Agder region, so the southern tip of Norway. That's where we have the biggest surplus of renewable energy in Norway, and the energy is massively fed by more than 100 power plants that runs on hydropower. And this is all year round, very resilient feed. So it's not like all river. We do also have river power plants there on hydro, but they also drain sort of lakes, high altitude lakes through tunnels, which was built since the 50s. So these are past generations investments into infrastructure for power.
We actually had the CEO of Arendals Fosse Company in this podcast.
He would know certainly.
He was very
that.
Proud of the Sameid, the whole industrial background. But then there is a bit like a new industrial revolution theme here, because we are using this power in a new way.
Yeah, so I think the same reasons why Sameid went to the same areas to develop the early phase of hydropower on large scalable business. You know, this is the nature down there. The landscape is not flat. It's rolling hills, and they go into mountains and high altitude lakes, which produce power on many different power stations running towards the sea. So you have a massive amount of power being stored and can be opened up when you need it, and you can shut down the power feed from the hydropower when you have wind power that comes in from shore. And of course, this is also the largest interconnector Norway has to the rest of Europe, which is running across to Denmark. So the Venezuela site is the junction between the Norwegian surplus of hydropower and the international export and import. So as we see Denmark and Germany getting more wind power, they sell wind power to Norway once the wind is blowing, and we sell hydropower back to them when the wind is not so efficient. So this is the major junction, I would say, for power interconnectivity in renewable energy in Europe.
And this is, in fact, a global phenomenon, this data center electricity usage. That's becoming a huge global phenomenon. And obviously, there is a lot of CO2 emissions because a lot of the electricity in the world is made by oil and gas.
Yep.
So I saw a slide that you made. You said that data centers could account for 13% of global electricity consumption and 6% of carbon footprint by 2030. That's quite massive numbers.
Yeah, these are there are many different assumptions in the market, but this is one that is used used quite a lot. And this is estimating also that the CO2 emissions from data centers itself will be three times as much as the airline industry was producing, you know, before the pandemic. So in just 10 years' time, and this is something that we in bulk want to look at because it's actually a global energy. It is. You need to consider how you process data and how you. It's a big energy management operations that we want to do, and we think the Nordic market is in the heart of it. We also think that there are other regions in the world like Atlantic Canada, which could also be a hub for large energy. Renewable energy process data. So these are things that we look at. How can we position ourselves in that market going forward? So we want to look around the next corner and see what's coming up next. And now power is the big question. Where do we have power in the future? And how do we create it?
And I think we maybe need to take a step back as well, because a data center is, of course, part of the global infrastructure for internet. So I also saw another slide that one Google search consumes the same amount of energy as turning on a light bulb for about 17 seconds. I think this is what people don't think about, is that when you actually, you know, use the internet, you use electricity. And so I think, you know, the big picture here is, of course, that, you know, we need to make sure that it's smart electricity, it's clean electricity, it's green electricity. And I'm still amazed, but Venezuela is a part of a global solution.
Yes. And data is, it comes in extremely, a lot of different shapes and forms. Some data can be stored for a long time, like a picture you take and you want to maybe use it in the next few hours because you want to share it with somebody. Or if you haven't used it for, you know, a certain amount of time, it goes into sort of a cold storage where it sort of rests and awaits for you to bring it back up and activate the picture again. So, and then you have data which, for instance, during the European football finals, we will watch television on stream, and you will see that people will maybe put it on hold for a while, and everybody has their own streaming process, and that is data that is sort of flowing through it. We don't store it for a long term. We just need to make sure that the data flows to your device. And you see it, and then when you've seen it, you may never go back and look at it again. So this is the streaming operations, and that's data centers that has connectivity and distribution of data. So there's, of course, other types of data that we see more and more, which is, we would like to call it high-performance computing. And this could be, for instance, the auto industry, trying to simulate, you know, a crash test, for instance, on their vehicles. So instead of crashing, you know, a full-size vehicle into a wall and just collect the data from that crash, which could be limited, they build sort of a replica and they simulate how the crash testing would do. And, you know, this data is performed by very, very power-hungry computers, and they could run for 2 days just to make a very, very, very short simulation of less than a second. So,
and this is before the self-driving cars, because the self-driving cars, that's another level, I think, of data usage.
Yeah, so a self-driving car would not depend on a data center sitting far away from it. It would need to sort of operate the data as it drives along the highway and act, on what it sees and what it sensors. So that's a different type of data, okay, which doesn't travel back to the data center. But it collects a lot of data still. So
it analyzes.
And then they send that data back from all these vehicles and they analyze the data. And if something goes wrong, they can make an analysis of what went wrong.
We touched upon it already, but we identified, and of course we have the power. So we have the green electricity. So Wennesla is a perfect hub, but we need fiber. That's the sort of next step, which that's a separate business area, but it's obviously very connected with the data center business area. But I'm very impressed because you have actually in your fiber division, I think you have amazing vision and you have partners that includes, as I mentioned, Amazon and also Google and Facebook. That's pretty big names. How was it to, hello, my name is Peter. I'm here to negotiate with Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, how can a relatively small company from Norway cooperate with these giants?
I would say very small in this case. Some years ago, we do have connectivity between the United States and the Nordic region. The old cable that had that connection was the 14th transatlantic cable, which was called TAT-14.
And that's quite old.
That's an old one. And it was coming up towards 20 years old. And they wanted to put in a new transatlantic cable that connects directly to the Nordics. And this was the first cable to be built into the North Sea from United States in 20 years. And this was the opportunity that we saw that somebody have to connect Norway to that cable, because that's the way that Norway directly also can interconnect with these other countries that the transatlantic cable would connect. And this was called the Havfrue cable. So we were in contact with Facebook and Google, who originally partnered up to build the cable. And they saw it as an opportunity that we would unlock Norway as well as a region for data processing. And I think, they didn't need us. They didn't maybe even want us. But
they could have bought the whole thing themselves. Or
yes, and that's usually what they do.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
they build these cables on their own because they need so much data to travel on long distance. But here they saw that our general purpose was bigger than just our company. We were not going to be just a company selling transatlantic capacity, but we wanted to unlock the Nordic region in a greater way to find to create more ways to interconnect. And data needs to travel, but it needs maybe three or even four routes, so that if there is any breakage on a cable because of external aggression, it could be fishing activity, it could be an anchor for a vessel when you're at sea, or it could be just a digging machine making a cut on the cable in the road.
Someone looking for oil, or maybe some green minerals on the end of the sea. I don't know.
Then they need at least three, maybe even four different routes, and this is what we call diversity. You know that, and they need to go on separate routes so that they are not there is no risk to come into the same problem on multiple cables. So that's what they've experienced over time. You know, when you have, especially when large numbers of cables comes into the shores of UK, for instance, we had a Norwegian vessel way back that cut a lot of the cables because it was very rough sea and it was in distress and it was anchored outside and it was drifting alongside the coast. And you can imagine what happened with the fiber cables laying on the bottom of that ocean.
Vulnerability for the whole infrastructure. So Netflix, for example, they trust and run all their services on Amazon Web Services. I think I read somewhere Netflix and Snapchat are the two biggest clients of Amazon Web Services. So let's say there's a fishman and he cuts the cable and then all of a sudden nobody in Norway can watch Netflix. And
that's why they make sure to have several cables.
Exactly. But then how if you can say a little bit, how does the economics work between you and Amazon and Google and Facebook? And so who's actually pay, is everyone that sends data paying for the sending the data back and forth on the cable?
No, the names you mentioned, Google and Facebook, they have a different role than Amazon.
Okay.
So this is a transatlantic cable coming from New Jersey into Denmark and Norway. And also we're developing now the branch into Ireland. So it will have four countries interconnected. And this is a joint build with Google and Facebook. So we all spend our money to get our fibers in the same system. And they will have their...
Is it public how much this 8,000 kilometer cable is costing?
No, it's not. But we sort of split that bill between the parties. And there's also another, Aquacoms is another company that's also part of the cable. So we have four partners. And so Google and Facebook and Aquacoms, they're partners in building the cable. And we all sort of take our own shares and then we develop that for our own needs. But Amazon Web Services, they are a customer of bulk onto our fiber systems on the same cable. So that's a different relationship then. But then
is Amazon a good customer, or do you? Some people sometimes say that if you're that rich, you don't become rich by being nice. So are they very stingy, very difficult to deal with?
There are a lot of nice people working there. So I don't think that's I think that's well taken care of. So, but they are an important customer to us because it also puts bulk on the map, because we do have more than just a transatlantic cable. We have networks, from Norway that we build now to Denmark to improve connectivity to Norway. We have the intercity ring interconnecting large cities in Norway. So we want to build these kind of long haul infrastructure that that large companies can use and buy what we call dark fiber, which is sort of the infrastructure product in a fiber business. It's to the opposite. It's not lit services where a company can buy 10 gigabit of data from point A to point B. So that's another service which we do not do. So we want to stay on the infrastructure layer. But coming back to your question on how do they pay, in the dark fiber business on the infrastructure layer, we usually work in IRUs, irrevocable right of use. So we sell the right to use an amount of fibers or parts of a fiber also.
Okay. So it's a little bit like when people are buying all you can eat data on your Telenor or Telia network, only in a
but they pay
billion.
They pay up front let's say 20 years or the lifetime of the cable. So it's very much a development project, and you sort of sell out the capacity to other that will use it over time, and then you have a margin on operations and maintenance during the period.
But I wasn't going to come to that yet, but I have to ask because it's just bugging me. It's not normal, is it, that one guy called Peder owns so much of this infrastructure? Isn't it normally owned by, Google, Facebook, or some huge infrastructure funds? I don't know, governments maybe? These fiber cables traditionally, who has been owning these cables traditionally?
Well, it was originally started by a large consortium of a lot of telco operators.
Yeah, exactly. Telia Global Carriers and Telenor exactly.
So they would then join forces in building a cable, and they would split the capacity between each owner of the consortium. But they got more and more complicated because there was a lot of different types of owners that changed hand over time, and the amount of data is increasing extremely over the last 10 years especially. And the old cables, they don't have a lot of capacity left. They have like the one that we built now has 1,000 times more capacity than the old TAT-14.
Right.
So it's not easy to compete with an old cable system because you have operations and maintenance cost on that, which then doesn't justify the amount of capacity you can sell on the cable. So new cables are extremely important because you also invest a lot on technology on both ends of the cable, and that technology would last perhaps for 10 years. And you don't want to invest, greatly on each end of the cable and only having maybe 2 years of remaining lifetime on the cable. So these are the kind of complexity that you get into once the older cables are there.
We have to move on to your third business area, which I understand is where it sort of all started, which is the industrial real estate. But yeah, a lot of guys have been making money from real estate. But I think that you didn't start with real estate. You started with a problem and to find a solution. What was that, Peter?
Yeah, I had initially back in 2004 and 5, I've been, I invested with some investment companies into logistics, and I thought it was an interesting niche because it was very nice cash flow. Usually you had, especially in Norway, where it's hard to find the right type of land because we have protected areas for forests sitting around Oslo, for instance, and also farmland is also protected. So you need to identify those forests which are not protected, or parts between farmlands that you could develop for industrial purposes. And in 2005 and 6, we talked about Oslo being the most polluted capital in Europe during wintertime, because we sit in the end of the fjord, we are surrounded with mountains, and in the wintertime when the air is not blowing through, we have the logistic hub, or we used to have the logistic hub downtown, basically, in Alnabru, which is sort of the hub of the railway. And the problem is that when all the trucks ran in and out of the city, they also made everybody else idle on the highways. So a lot of idle driving in and out of the Oslo region was a result of that. And I saw that, okay, somebody has to move the logistics out. We need to get the logistics out to the places where they can more efficiently go to and from their warehouses or deliveries. And I started zoning land for data center, for logistics outside of Oslo, alongside the E6, which is the main highway, going both north and south of Oslo. And the logistics, they were changing also into more scalable warehouses because they were also now at that point being allowed to drive longer vehicles on the roads. So this was a test drive for some time, but later it became permanent to have 25 meters long vehicles on the highways in Norway. And this then requires more maneuver space outside of the buildings. So you couldn't go into a congested city with small areas in front of the docks to move around these vehicles. So they wanted to go also into larger, more efficient warehouses. And we developed two types of warehouses, you know, just one that you store goods over time and deliver to the customer when they need. And also we delivered what was, you know, coming at the time, but hadn't been in Norway, but that was cross-dock terminals. So terminals that you just switch the goods from one vehicle to another just to deliver it to the customer in time.
And you made a lot of money, I think, by making the logistics operations a little bit better. It was not a revolution, it was more like an evolution. You changed the land, or you built up new sites, and you changed a few things on each logistics centers.
I think the companies that were building these buildings, they looked upon it as a very one-off type of construction, and nobody was really paying attention to do it again and again and over in Norway at the time. So I thought, I looked at the cost of building these types of buildings in Norway, compared it to Sweden, for instance. And although we have different fire regulations in those two countries, and snow loads are a bit different because we need more capacity on the roofs in Norway because of more snow. Then besides that, it was a game changer to just adapt their way of building these kind of buildings. So I went to France and I picked up one of the biggest contractors for logistics in the world. And I asked them politely if they would come to Norway and build about 30,000 square meters a year for us in Norway. And they said yes. So this was at a good timing because it was just after the
crisis,
financial crisis, or it was actually in that time. So they were looking for business elsewhere also because of the slump elsewhere in Europe. So bit of luck there, but they taught us a lot of things on how to build quicker, more efficiently, how to sort of They taught the whole industry, I think, in Norway. And now everybody does the same. It's less difference now between what we are able to achieve and our competitors. But we still have an edge, I think. So,
but that's maybe why you're spending a little bit more time on data centers and fibers. But you've done more than 36 projects completed since 2008, 30 projects sold with an accumulated value north of 5 billion NOK. Big, impressive numbers. You have some very impressive clients. XXL, Paul Wiebe was here in the Arctic podcast. He's sounds like he was growing a lot, pandemic winner. And I also noticed that one of your latest clients is the guy who was here last week, PetXL. I thought it was a quite good podcast, but he was unhappy because he said that I didn't ask enough questions about PetXL. what type of client is that?
Well, that's logistics
it sounds like somewhere between XXL and pets. So,
you get the idea. It's getting, I think the concept is for the pet stores to be more efficiently, logistically operated as well. And what we've seen, we build with Nille. So when you mentioned Paul Wiebe, he was in Nille time when we built for Nille. And that was the first project that the GSE, the French contractor, did in Norway. So that was also a learning curve for us. But these companies, several of our customers are owned by private equity companies or have been owned by private equity companies. They see that the efficiency of logistics that's where they can possibly move one company from a status quo into the next generation of that company. And the margins, for instance, that XXL spend on their logistics is amazing, and people didn't believe it.
It's working capital management. That's the thing I didn't learn enough about that when I went to Norwegian Business School in Bergen, Anaheim. But it's working capital management, which is a big part of logistics.
Yes. So if you have 5% of your capital spent, or the cost of your goods spent on logistics, or you have 14, you know, you know, 9% down the drain for the other one. So this is becoming, important also in the Norwegian market, or did become important. So we caught a lot of attention, and our customers have been very satisfied with the process because we helped them from all our experience on different projects. We helped them to rethink what they're doing or save money on stuff. We are, a player that doesn't want the highest rent. So we want actually a low rent because that's very financiable, because we see that there is a partnership between the tenant that will give us, long terms on triple net contracts. And we have a steady cash flow for an average of 12 years. And then in return, we give them a fairly low rent to pay. And the bank sees that the residual risk on the project once the lease contract runs out is actually very low compared to other projects where they squeeze the last a buck for the rent, and you get a very high rental risk on the exit of the contract.
So Peter, did you learn all of your business tricks from your education, which I believe was 1 year at the London School of Foreign Trade?
That's a long time ago. But it was an interesting year. I didn't know what to do after my high school studies and our compulsory military service in Norway. And I heard a friend was going to London to study.
Went along for the ride.
So I thought that sounds like a great year, because it was just a 1 year of study. And
efficient.
Very efficient. Mm-hmm. And shipping was the main course on that study.
And you worked in shipping afterwards?
Yeah. So in shipping, it's sort of learning by doing type of thing. You go to the floor and you go through different processes. You learn your tricks and trades, and you become either a ship broker or a charter or something in that field. And for me, I worked in dry cargo shipping, which was grain and coal, and in my particular case, I worked for steel companies as well.
Is that where you got the idea for Bulk as a name of your?
Yes, I think honestly, yes. It's I used to say if you pull a large Capesize vessel onto the shore, you have a warehouse. So
that's a good point.
So more the merrier, the larger the better.
I have to ask about your colleagues, because it does sound like you have a lot on your plate with the logistics, the fiber, the data centers. I read an article or an interview with you, and it said, sort of directly translated, that Peter knows what he's not good at.
Yes.
How do you know what you're not good at, and what do you need good colleagues to help you with?
I think, to be honest, I think knowing yourself is quite important, and be honest with what you are good at and not good at. And I was lucky enough to serve as an officer in the Navy, and part of the officer training is actually, you know, for you to understand what your capabilities are. I think that's something that that probably. A lot of people find useful after serving compulsory in Norway. Now it's changed a little bit, but still. And then I could find my partners when I started Bulk. They were completely opposite from me. Not as friends, because we did grow up together. We were three partners that started Bulk with Torbjørn Moe still being in the company, and Trygve Roald, who sold out in 2011, and these are still good friends, but we had different skill sets. So I'm sort of the developer, a guy that sees opportunities and look around the next corner to see what's happening next and try to position ourselves into that. But both Trygve and Torbjørn, they had the skills of Torbjørn being the engineer. You know, when we needed to build something, he was the one that actually went ahead and made sure we got it built with the right people. And Trygve was a lawyer and had the experience as a tax lawyer and a real estate lawyer. And you know, a lot of the transactions we did was buying companies and looking at the, you know, both tax positions and write-offs. And this was a skill set which was very, very handy, especially around when we started Bulk, because of some changes in the tax regime in Norway as well. And actually, we did buy the first building we bought was originally negotiated to be bought for almost 90 million kroners. And then we found out that the seller wanted to give all his money to, or most of his money to, his kids, because it was a shift of generations. And we said, okay, well, let's just buy your company, and then with the tax, we would buy that company at a much lower cost than when we had originally planned to buy the property. And he would be able to give more money to his daughter and his son, and it was a great benefit, because then we had already had the financing based on the 90 million, so we didn't have to spend any equity.
Arbitrage.
It was 100,000 kroners actually, but that building is still in our portfolio, and we probably will never sell that.
Sounds like
one.
It's close to your heart.
And that is close to our heart.
So we're ending on sort of a visionary note, because obviously you've been quite visionary, taking your real estate investments, going into data centers, fibers. So Big Stan, chairman of Nordic Semiconductor, among other things, he said on this podcast that data is much bigger than oil. But I think you look upon it as not only data, it's more, what is Norway going to live of after the oil?
Power management.
Power.
Yeah, so all the industries that are developing now, especially in and around data, you have battery factories, you have a lot of other type of power-consuming industries. Norway and the Nordics in general, we have a long tradition of running critical infrastructure for power-hungry businesses. It has been aluminum plants, you mentioned earlier, paper mills. We don't see those around anymore.
That's true.
I tried to convince one of the paper mill companies to convert also into data centers, but they didn't bite back in in the days. But power management is so important. You have, in this case, you have the power cannot go down. So you cannot have a power outage for these services.
And I think the internet cannot go down, but the people don't think that internet is actually relying on power. That's sort of, we're one step behind this sort of internet or you know, Wi-Fi connection that people, internet is down, what should we do? But it's actually, power is more important than internet.
Well, yes, I think you probably don't want to have an outage of any of them if you need internet for your services, and most of us do.
Yeah.
And especially during the pandemic, we've seen how important the internet is and how vulnerable
we are.
Yes, and you have now education is happening online for a lot of kids around the world. And you can imagine people, being dependent on physical distribution or just having a book to read over the next few weeks or until you get a new book. It's been very challenging. And it's been very clear that all people are sort of dependent on digital infrastructure. And that's why fiber networks and data centers will always belong somewhat together as digital infrastructure. So like I was alluding to, Norway and the Nordics has been running, critical infrastructure for all these old types of industries. And they did not have a diesel gensets to back up their power. So we built an extremely resilient grid network.
Green,
but also the most resilient grid network in the world. You can find in Norway. So
yeah, and you mentioned the snow.
Yeah, but this is the power lines that feeds into one place. So like in Venezuela, like we started out with, there's 12 independent feeds of power going into that same junction, the same substation. So you can attach to several different feeds of power. You don't need, diesel gensets to back up. You can store that on batteries, for instance, and you will have each of these lines on the regional or central grid is so resilient historically as well, that they could by themselves, just two feeds would be more resilient than three feeds in other countries. So there is that's one of the benefits you find in the Nordic region. And also, I think the Nordic region is very far ahead on public services, on how they develop digital data and how we process it and how we service our nations, with the digital services. And we're quite far ahead in the world for that. And I think a lot of companies in and around the world will be born in that space where you actually do digital services for public services, for instance. And the transformation that we see will happen in the Nordics, it's already happening. And data processing needs to be part of that. And that's where we have so resilient power feed and dependability on our network infrastructure. So it is going to grow. It will grow because it have to grow. They are all looking for where to place themselves in the most sustainable way. And we have talked about greenwashing, which is what we have seen for maybe the last 10 years, is larger companies, they invest in a wind farm, but they also invest in a power-hungry data center or other types of services that carves out more than the wind farm. Or when the wind is not blowing, they will still depend on the backup for other grids. So they're actually carving out the green power that they produce in that region. And this is where they should change. They should still invest in wind and solar farms into these areas in Europe that lack renewable energy, but offset their data processing to a place where you have a surplus of renewable energy, and these surpluses that we want to unlock with our infrastructure.
Ellen Abbe, it's been inspiring. Thank you very much for spreading your energy in the Arctic podcast. We were recording this on the first day, the 17th of June. We'll be back next week with another exciting guest, but thank you, Pelle.
You're welcome.
This podcast has been prepared by Arctic for information purposes only. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. The information provided in this podcast is not intended to constitute investment advice, nor is the information intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any financial instrument. Relevant and specific professional advice should always be obtained before making any investment or credit decision. It is important to note that past performance is not indicative of future results. This podcast does not fulfill the criteria for preparing investment research and must be seen as marketing material. All information submitted during this podcast is obtained from public sources that Arctic believes to be reliable, but which Arctic has not independently verified. Arctic makes no guarantee, representation, or warranty as to its accuracy or completeness. No liability whatsoever is accepted for any direct or indirect, including consequential, loss or expense arising from the use of information from this podcast.